So what I wanted to offer tonight is a offering about how to work with the mantra Buddha. And this is odd because I've never ever had anyone give a teaching about how to work with the mantra Buddha in all these years. So kind of fell out on a limb, but insofar as, you know, we're sort of Buddhist in a broader sense, but probably more connected to Thai forest tradition than any other particular tradition in this group. And Buddha's used in Thai forest tradition a lot. And my nature, as I used to be a journalist, as some of you know, my nature is always to kind of burrow down into root sources and things. And I've been stumbling across it a lot. So wanted to offer this and see if it's helpful. And let me back up a little bit, because part of what we're always working with in our practice is the balance or of steadiness of attention, which is sometimes called concentration, but the balance of that and mindfulness and kind of how we work those together. It's the ongoing journey, part of the ongoing journey of our practice. And it's all different for different people according to their temperaments and all those things. But those are two major chords of what our meditation practice is. And in terms of what we're trying to do, it's always good to remember what we're trying to do in Theravada Buddhist tradition. And in Buddhist tradition in general, we're practicing to find the ultimate freedom of not clinging, of nibbana, of not suffering. And to do that, we need to see through all the conditioning that distracts us. If we can see through it, we're good. But that's easier said than done, as you know. And so in our meditation practice, part of what we do is we gradually awaken. Because of being cultivating mindfulness, we awaken to the impermanence of all things and the lack of inherent self in all things. And the grip phenomena and conditioning and life has on us lessons, and we get freer through that. So mindfulness, that's the key, right? To be mindful, to be aware moment by moment. That's the key core practice that we're doing. And when we're truly aware of anything, we can see how it is. We can see the nature of reality. But the puzzle is that our minds, our conditioning, our programming, our traumas, our everything, they got other plans for us. And instead of seeing the nature of reality, we get distracted by everything. And so for most of us, we kind of bounce around like monkeys in a candy store, some of us, during practice or even during life. And that's, you know, the term monkey mind comes out of that. Although monkeys in a candy store is even more vivid. They like candy. Yes. I've been around monkeys, and you don't mess with monkeys when there's candy involved. So this kind of gets at the balance, you know, between mindfulness and steady attention. And steady attention, it's called concentration sometime, which is kind of like not such a great translation because it feels like it's really tight. And people think they got to squeeze into this tightness. And it's meditative absorption is a much better word for where it's going to, or samadhi, because there's a real energy aspect to it, to settle into steadiness. And, you know, it's a funny deal. I won't name names, but I know three different people I consider friends who have the innate skill to just slide right into pretty deep states of absorption. And they can go up through the jhanas. There's eight jhanas in what the Buddha taught. But they're pretty rare. Most of us, not so easy. And that's okay. We are who we are. The real point is mindfulness. The real point is insight and wisdom and kindness. The other things are tools. So we shouldn't get hung up on that or competitive about absorption, not absorption. And mindfulness, you know, it works even in difficult situations, which is part of why it's so wonderful. You know, it works when we're in pain. As Robin has shared with us a lot, I hope that's okay to say, when we're going through a medical condition, it's very painful. It's so helpful. And it works when we're having a difficult moment with the person we love best. If we can really be mindful of all the storm of stuff that's going on, then we can actually arrive. So it doesn't have to be this like you know, peaceful centeredness for mindfulness to work. That's part of why it's so amazing here in the 21st century. But having said all that, it is good to cultivate steadiness of attention. It's really worth doing. Cultivate it, just don't get hung up on whether it's happening or not. But cultivate, cultivate. Because it really does make it, and you can get into subtler levels of insight when our minds are steady, we can get subtler and moves towards stream entry and nibbana. So, the general instruction and what the Buddha taught is to be mindful of four foundations, start off with the breath. That's a, you know, that's what the Buddha taught. That's a great place to go. But some of us can be served by also working with Buddha or some other tool like that, mantra like that. But Buddha is a classic one. It can be helpful for some of us. So that's what I want to offer a little bit. And it's a little tricky territory for me. I feel a little, because it's not taught in the West. I mean, I kind of stumbled on it backwards. So even people who are in Thai forest lineage don't talk about it much. So it's gotten me, I mean, I've been working on this for years, but it's gotten me a long time to feel comfortable to share it with you. And a little bit about me that sort of has a little bit about why this is, I've been doing this stuff since I was, a long time since I was 20. So the first 15 years of my practice was mostly in Raja Yoga in Hindu tradition. Spent some time in an ashram in India, although I've also spent 6 years in the hippie commune, to be sure, a spiritual hippie commune. But in terms of the underlying practice, I was coming at it from a Raja Yoga point of view, in which mantra is really important and it's extremely common, almost universal, that people practicing concentration practice, jhana, is this kind of steadiness of attention, they use mantras. So I just got so used to that. It's kind of in my bones somewhere. So it's part of why I think I was trying to figure out this aspect in Buddha world. But I checked. I literally checked with Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield about even doing this a couple years ago. And I'm going to read what they said. Joseph said, well, he said, good to hear from you. But he said, I think it's fine to introduce Buddha as a technique. It's not that different from using a mental note with each breath. And there have been some teachers here at IMS in the Achan Cha tradition that have used it. One of my favorite personal mantras is, whatever works. And Jack said, good to hear from you, and to know that you are using all you've learned and passing the teachings on to others. Okay. Of course it is fine to use that mantra. Blessings on your teaching it. Some people find it really helpful. It helps to steady and calm and steady the heart and mind. Then, with quiet and steady and focused mind, both understanding and insight grow, as well as greater access to loving compassion. That is really beautiful. So, just a stamp of approval to do this funny thing. And as some of you know, I'm prone to quoting quite a bit. I read quotes when I'm teaching a lot because there's amazing people who are like actually masters, so why not hear from them? And in this case, I'm not going to be quoting the Buddha, but I am going to be quoting in particular, there's, in Thai forest lineage, there was a teacher named Ajahn Mun who kind of revolutionized practice, and he was in the late 19th century, I think I should know. And into early 20th century. And Ajahn Mun he really basically did what the Buddha did and went off in the forest in Thailand and wandered. He never stopped wandering. He wandered his entire practice life as a wandering yogi. You don't stop during rain retreat. But just really revitalized the whole idea of people actually awakening from doing practice. There was a sort of a feeling in some of the monastic situation in Thailand, you couldn't actually awaken anymore. That was back at the Buddha's time. You couldn't do that now. So better just study the Dharma. But he did it. He did it. And from him, a lot of people, there was a lot of sort of proliferation out of that. But Achan Cha, who many of you know, is the teacher of Jack Kornfield, for one thing, and Achan Cha lineage, the two Clear Mountain Monastery monks over in Seattle come out of that. So Achan Cha, he met Ajahn Mun for 2 days, basically. met him, stayed for a day, left the next day, the third day. So had incredible, but it was pivotal for him. And then Ajahn Buwa studied with him for a long time. And I've read a lot of Ajahn Buwa's stuff. And he's amazing. And he died. It's incredible. YouTube you can find. In 2010, he did his last teaching and died in 2011, Ajahn Buwa. And it's really amazing. I mean, a lot of people think he was an arhat. You can kind of feel he's just like, he's almost, he said, my body's just failing. I can hardly even talk, but he just lays it out there. So amazing. So, and Ajahn Buwa says in this amazing book, he says, regardless of whether I was seated in meditation, walking meditation, or simply doing my daily chores, the word Buddha resonated deeply within my mind at all times. This is kind of how these guys navigate that. In terms of how it works and just kind of what I'm just going to suggest four areas that we might benefit if we are so moved. In formal sitting meditation, when just out in the world, dealing with the complexities of the world, driving down the street, whatever. When confronting difficulties and as a way to just refresh our sense of direction, Buddha is really helpful for all these. If it's something you want to do, only if it works for you, right? This is just an offering, not saying what to do. But formal meditation, what we've been doing, it can be an excellent tool in stabilizing the mind. And we're not trying to squash thinking or make thinking stop. We're trying to cultivate awareness of what is. But if thinking will calm down some, that's cool, because we can see more clearly, but it's not bad when it arises, because then it naturally arose. But in the kind of maneuvering through that, Buddha can be really helpful, because steadiness of attention can lead us to deeper insight. In a lot of Southeast Asian tradition, they say, and this is not the way it's taught here, but there are some teachers in Thailand and Burma also that say, first you establish the jhanas, you establish concentration, then you do insight. Which might work if you're in a monastic situation where all you're doing is practicing. For Westerners, most of us can't begin to do that. It's just, if that's the sequence, we can't do it. So it just doesn't work. So for most of us, that's why mindfulness is taught first in IMS world and all that, because most people can't do jhanas. But if we can get more steady, that's good. More steady is good. And mindfulness of breathing is how the Buddha taught. It's a time-tested method, just to be aware of the breathing as it goes in and out, to kind of rest your attention. They said Steve Armstrong used to say, just like caressing the back of your hand, just feel it, very tactile. You know, just feel the breath. That's wonderful. And the breath is so cool. It has no content. It doesn't distract us. It's always there. As long as we're alive, it's there. It's kind of like a metronome. And if our attention quiets, the breath quiets. Some of you may notice when you really start to get focused, the breath quiets and gets thinner and thinner and smaller and smaller. It's pretty amazing how it kind of walks with us. But sometimes we need something more. And Buddha can really be helpful. So there's this great book. Some of you read Stillness Flowing. Has anyone read Stillness Flowing? Yeah, a little bit. Stillness Flowing is highly recommends the biography of Ajahn Chah, written by Ajahn Jayasaro, who you may remember came here some months ago to visit Clear Mountain. It was quite amazing. He lives in Thailand. He's a Westerner. It's a great, great, great book. I've read it three times or something. I'm always reading it and picking out parts of it. And if you do want to read it, my suggestion would be to download it for free, by the way, from a Bayagiri website. Because if you get the physical one, it's about this big. And it's kind of heavy. But you can get it, you can download it in an Mobi form, which works on a Kindle. So it all works, all the Kindle stuff works. So there you go. But in that book, Jayasaro writes, in order to help meditators anchor their mind on the breath, Luang Por, which is another word for Ajahn Chah, recommended using the mantra Buddha, mentally reciting Bud on the inhalation and Do on the exhalation. And like I said, this is real common, using a mantra with inhaling and exhaling in Hindu tradition. And I used to, actually I do a little bit of Sanskrit. I won't confuse things by saying what it was, but it really works. And Buddha is very similar in terms of sort of the texture of it. Especially in the, if you work with it in the exhalation aspect, the Do part, it just fades out like that. very different from Buddha, which is a sharp vowel. The do, it kind of fades and it can take you right into stillness. And then inhale happens. So you really work with it, but it really helps you stay attentive to the entire cycle of the breath. Because that's what the Buddha is talking about when he talks about staying with the full body of the breath, staying with, there's different interpretations, but that's the main one, the full cycle of the breath, not just sort of thinking about following the breath, but actually staying with it, just writing it out for the full cycle. And this can be really helpful. And especially that the fading out, and then it stops. There's like, and then breath comes back in. And if you're prone to thinking or planning or all that stuff, you know, using Budo can be real helpful. It helps steady the mind, helps us retain mindfulness so we're not kind of sucked away. It kind of keeps, it's just an extra tool to bring us back. Ajahn Buddha said, it's a little bit long, but it's so cool. He said, if you find it helpful, combine your breathing with a silent repetition of Budo, thinking Bud on the point of inhalation and Do on the point of exhalation. Don't allow errant thoughts to interfere with the work you are doing. This is an exercise in awareness of the present moment, so remain alert and fully attentive. As mindfulness gradually establishes itself, the mind will stop paying attention to harmful thoughts and emotions. It will lose interest in its usual preoccupations. Undistracted, it will settle further and further into calm and stillness. At the same time, the breath, which is coarse when you first begin focusing on it, gradually becomes more and more refined. It may even reach the stage when it completely disappears from your conscious awareness. It, the breath, becomes so subtle and refined that it fades and disappears. There is no breath at that time. Only the mind's essential knowing nature remains. So, oh, by the way, that's a realized master speaking there, not me, him. That is so amazing, right? That is so amazing. And you know, it's sort of like in practice, you sort of, each of us has to use your intuition and be flexible and see what works. You know, when do you step toward Buddha? When do you step back? How do you work with that? You have to, if you're drawn to it, you have to play around, basically. And there's a time to let it go, as he's sort of saying. There'll be a time to let it go. And first jhana has thoughts still. Second jhana has no thoughts. If you're getting into second jhana, you won't be doing Buddha anymore because you'll be in a state of deep samadhi. So it's not something you hold on to all the time, but it can be a really useful tool in the interim. Ajahn Buddha said, and he's so fierce. There's this great book about how we, I can't remember the name. I can tell you if you're interested in, it's another download from Abhaya Giri, basically how he awakened. But he says, he's talking about his practice life. And he says, this time I first drove a stake firmly into the ground and held tightly to it no matter what happened. That stake was Buddha, the recollection of the Buddha. I made the meditation word Buddha the sole object of my attention. I focused on the mental repetition of Buddha to the exclusion of everything else. Buddha became my sole objective, even as I made sure that mindfulness was always in control to direct the effort. So this is a pretty fierce dude, you know, and he's a solitary meditator out in the forest, living on his own, little alms round once a day to get a little bit of eat, except when he doesn't, that's it, under a tree, in a cave. But we can do what we can do. And an aspect of this, I'm just going to touch on a few aspects to consider, is the, depends where you're at and how you think about things, but the power or energy of the word itself. You know, whether, because mantras in Sanskrit world, in Hindu world, mantras are considered as, you know, the very Sanskrit vowels have power to them and they're laden with power inherently. It's not talked about and thought about quite the same way in Buddhist world, but I think there's some aspects of that are in fact happening here. And this is like, you know, over my pay grade, but these Buddha, you know, there's all the whole river of the evolution of practice going back to the time of the Buddha 2,600 years ago and prior to that. There's a lot of interweaving, and, you know, Buddhism was in India for up until about the 12th century to a large degree, or 13th century, or 14th, I can't remember, 14th, something like that. So it's all interwoven. So I guess my point is just approach this with a certain openness that that word may have some actual potency that'll really make a difference. It's not just a word. And, you know, I think, because sometimes, and there's good teachings to use counting. You know, count up to 10, count back down. That's cool. If that works for you, do it. But the numbers don't have potency in the same way. Buddha may be different. So I leave it up to you to consider, but it may, depending on your karma, how it resonates, carry you forward in a way that numbers might not. So listen, you know, inwardly listen. If you decide to try it, inwardly listen and see what your experience is. And also, in fact, the word Buddha is a version of the name of the Buddha. So when we're using that word, we're aligning us with the Buddha and aligning us with Buddha mind or the awakened nature of the Buddha's mind. So there's a lot of alignment going on. It's pretty powerful stuff. It really helps us see what our potential is just from checking in because, you know, here in 2024, I mean, we're asked to align with all kinds of stupid stuff. You know, we could align with binge watching and Netflix or political strife or, you know, getting a new Lexus or whatever. But this is aligning us with possibility of awakened mind. And it's an important part of using it in the practice because it keeps us on track. We don't wander off. As he was saying, the distractions become less distracting. It just doesn't matter. It's just tinsel. That was a cool, in the commune, we used to talk about distractions with tinsel. We used a lot. I kind of liked it. That was a good word. So it keeps reminding us what we're about, how we're focused on awakening, the natural sacredness of our potential. And, you know, it's always important to remember that we're not, like, in this journey of practice. We're not creating awakened mind. It's not like we're making something up. We're revealing it. We're just peeling away the stuff that's in the way. So it's not like because how can we make that up? We don't even know what it is. We're just getting out of the way. We're peeling the obscurations, and then it becomes apparent. It gets simpler, simpler, and simpler. And it may seem like, really, that's like, I'm a train wreck. How could that be? But actually, you're not a train wreck. You folks are amazing, and the mere fact that something draws you to sit together means that's already happened a lot. There's a lot has already been uncovered. You have intuitions that you may not even realize you do. So you're doing good. You're doing good. Achan Cha said, meditate reciting Buddha, Buddha until it penetrates deep into your heart. The word Buddha represents the awareness and wisdom of the Buddha. In practice, you must depend on this word more than anything else. The awareness it brings will lead you to understand the truth about your own mind. It is a true refuge as it includes both mindfulness and insight. When your mind is consciously applied to an object, it wakes up. The awareness wakes it up. Once this knowing has arisen through meditation, you can see the mind clearly. As long as the mind remains without the awareness of Buddha, even if there is an ordinary worldly presence of mind, it will not lead you to what is truly beneficial. Sati or mindfulness depends on the presence of Buddha, the knowing. It must be a clear knowing, which leads to the mind becoming brighter and more radiant. So that is pretty cool. It's kind of a different version of what Ajahn Buddha said, but kind of the same direction. I want to touch a little bit about how we can use this word in other ways also, like in the world, you know, at the supermarket checkout line, when you're pulling through an intersection, when you're walking by people on a sidewalk. I use it a lot. And just repeating the word Buddha out there in the world can just transform everything. It just becomes sacred space. Just like, that wasn't mundane, that's sacred. And it can just help us open up to our Buddha nature. And it's not like believing in something. I'm absolutely not a faith. I'm really my journalist self. I've never been a faith person. Like, I don't want to believe in something unless I see it. But try it out. You know, you just kind of just work with the word Buddha in the midst of it. You know, sometimes loving kindness is exactly the thing to do. Sometimes just settling with your breath is the thing to do. Sometimes Buddha is really helpful. So you might add it to your repertoire, your palate. Or toolbox, whatever you want to say, not arsenal, but toolbox. And so you might, in this case, you might not link it to the breath, but just recite it more rhythmically. If you have a mala, you know, like a wrist mala like this, you can just go, you know, Buddha, 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 silently to yourself. And that's what malas are for. So it can really be helpful to not just be kind of lost in the stew. And it often elevates the entire circumstance, and you can, you know, it becomes really clear to be kind to that person or to have a kind attitude toward some person. I was struggling today. I was walking through Kirkland, and there's a homeless lady that I've seen a lot. She's in the hospital, but man, she's in bad. I can't imagine she's going to live very much longer. I mean, she was just collapsed over, and I don't know if I should have done something, but she was writing a major thing, so I'm sure everybody knew her better, the police knew her better. But I found this was really helpful to kind of, rather than recoiling, because, you know, she was not attractive, to see the sacredness of it. And, you know, there's an aspect of spiritual practice, which is training the mind, is cultivating the wholesome and shedding the unwholesome. That's part of what we're doing in practice. We're cultivating the wholesome. That's part of what Sila is about, all the ethical choices. It's part of what loving kindness is about, just cultivating loving kindness, not hatred. Ethical choices, not the selfishness that makes us, any of us, steal or lie or all the five precepts. Because if we're kind, then we won't do those. So it's about cultivating the wholesome. Buddha talks about it a lot. It's a huge part of how meditation works. You gotta work the wholesome to make it work. And Buddha is a way to help cultivate that. And it can help us not be distracted. Ajahn Mun said, and it might have been Ajahn Buwa, I think it was actually Ajahn Buwa, he said, the longer I internalized Buddha, the more subtle the citta became, the mind, until eventually the subtlety of Buddha and the subtlety of the citta melded into one another and became one and the same essence of knowing. And then I'll be just kind of be quick with these last two, so I'll have time to talk. But a third use is when things get difficult, you know, when things are gnarly, and to see if it's helpful. I mean, this can be, I've had, like, personally, a series of rather odd dreams. They're, like, difficult. I woke up, it's like, whoa, what was that in the middle of the night with this pretty creepy dream? I didn't used to have creepy dreams. I don't know what the deal is, but, and I'm just like, it's time to light it up with white energy, you know, and just, I'll just start doing Buddha, right? When I wake up, just turn to white energy and turn to love and not sink down into some morass, and it turns it. You know, I could sit there and wallow and be freaked out, but it's all in my mind, so just turn it. And do Buddha right there at 3 a.m. lying in bed. And it totally can transform it. So, you know, we've all got our, I don't know, demons is the right word, we've all got our conditionings, our traumas, our stuff. I mean, I don't know where my dreams are coming from, who knows, but lifetime, whatever. But it's a way to just step into it and turn the energy. Just turn the energy. And sometimes there's, you know, there, who knows? It may be that there's some, you know, entities, beings, earthbound entities, whatever around you may encounter. It depends where you're at on that whole arena. But if that's part of your cosmology, it can be really helpful. Back in the commune, this is like, I'm sorry, I'm getting off this. Oh, why not? in the commune days, back when I lived in the Spirit, in Massachusetts, Brotherhood of the Spirit, very amazing place. And we had this, it was a very vibrant energy. We're out in the country. And there was this notion, I honestly think it was true, that there was this, we called it the Krishna bubble. There was this big bubble of energy over the commune. And if you walked down the road in late at night and kind of got like a half a mile, and so you went out of the Krishna bubble, and then it got really weird. And almost like all these entities were hovering around. And people went, if they walked down the road, they really had to work on their bright energy. And I wasn't using Budo, but they were kind of using, you know, Christ consciousness or love or something, or just white energy. But personally, I think there's something to that stuff. So I don't go too far afield, but if something comes at you, if you just feel like, sometimes you ever feel creepy? Does anyone ever feel like just creepy stuff comes at them? Yeah, okay, see, I'm sitting nodding. This can be a really good thing to do. Just change it. Just work on what's going on in the energy in your mind. Who knows where exactly it is? It doesn't matter. Just work with it. And Budo is a great tool. It's a really great tool. Long retreat, too. Long retreat, very weird stuff can come up because, you know, everything comes up in long retreat. So to be able to work with Budo then is really helpful. So, and then, you know, if you got a, I mean, I'm married 34 years, and, you know, most of the time it's great. Ellen's an amazing being. And there's no one who knows each other better than me and Ellen, and we trip into our hot buttons and things get difficult. And we, and at this point, we have some very different views about certain things, political or whatever. And if it seems like it's an adversarial connection with anybody, reciting Budo right then can just open it up. Like, what? Who? What's the other? Like, it kind of falls apart. Who is this other that's an adversary to me? It kind of goes away. It's Budo. There's like Buddha, Buddha, and Buddha. You know, the potential. Two potential Buddhas maneuvering in the same space. That is like, it's really not a problem. You can just kind of lift it right open. So you can really bring that into any heated moment or political circumstance or a person that you love who has a very different view than you politically or whatever. You know, just bring it in there. It's really, really, it's kind of like loving kindness, but it's another kind of, because this is a tool, another kind of way at coming at that. It really emphasizes the Buddha nature. Try it out. And then lastly, and this is just a brief one, but Buddha can be really helpful in just refreshing our sense of direction, our kind of inner compass. Because it can be hard. What are we doing? Like, what am I doing with my practice? What am I trying? Why am I doing this? You know, what? It can be hard to remember because we're sort of faking it till we make it. You know, it's sort of like a catch-22. And if we were awakened, it'd be obvious, but we're not awakened, so it's not obvious. And how do we navigate that? And sometimes when it's just like, I'm kind of like, I sort of feel like I lost track. I just recite Buddha a few times and go, oh yeah, I got it. I remember. It sort of like clarifies direction. So it's a great direction clarifier. That's what I got. Let's sit for a few minutes.
Can you demonstrate how you do it with your breath?
Pardon me?
Can you demonstrate how you do it with your breath?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just say it out loud. Just go, well, it's kind of, it's hard to say it out loud. But just boo on the inhale and do on the exhale, kind of like that. Just in the mind, you know. But boo, do, kind of like that. Okay. Sit for a moment or two. Just to let things sink in.